This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I would argue that you could also die from standing up.
Well, how is that, Jamie?
You could fall over, pass out from standing up so long. You can't sit for 8 hours a day.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Fordham's own part of the royal family, Janie Skull.
I hope I'm the queen.
The princess.
Okay, I'll take princess. Princess is good enough.
So have you been following the royal wedding stuff at all?
I haven't been following it necessarily, but I will admit I'm considering waking up to watch it.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, why wouldn't I? It's probably one of the only royal weddings that'll happen in my lifetime. I mean, I'm sure there'll be a couple more, but not for years.
I think I watched Princess Diana's wedding. I have faint recollections. Anybody know when that would have been?
1981.
Early 80s.
All right, yeah. So I would have been like 8. Yeah, I have that memory. And sure, so what time do you have to wake up to watch it?
I think the actual ceremony starts at like 6 a.m. here, or maybe 5 a.m.
Okay.
I don't think I would wake up for like full procession at like 3:30.
Is that early? They get started that early, 6 hours ahead, right?
Yeah. So I think it's like a 10 or 11 o'clock wedding, wherever they are.
That's pretty early.
Yeah.
So I saw something that there's been twice as much media coverage of the royal wedding in the United States as in the UK.
Yeah, for some reason it's gotten everyone really jazzed up.
Yeah.
I think it's because we're not used to, you know, hearing about royals and hearing about queens and princesses. Yeah. And it's just exciting for us.
Very fun. All right, good. Well, unfortunately, we can't spend our whole time here on the Education Gadfly Show talking about the royals. We have other important business to do. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute, Chris's What's Up With That, and we can speculate on where the heck is Rick Hess today. We haven't seen Rick in a little while.
That's kind of like Where's Waldo?
Yeah.
We should have a giant map of the world.
And he hasn't been blogging either, and that makes me kind of sad. I try to read his blog when he's not there, but I have to say I don't get very far. I'm just like, I mean, whoever these people are that are blogging for him, they seem very nice. I just, you know, I want to know. I want to say, what's Rick think about something? And Rick, we miss you.
Phone.
We missed you, man. All right. Daniela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Okay. Question number one. We heard from some smart folks during our event this week on the future relevance and necessity of school boards in America. What do you guys think? Are school boards vital in the 21st century?
Are they, Mike?
Are they, Janie?
are they?
All right. Yeah. So this was the question. Look, this was kind of a wimpy question we asked. Are they vital in 21st century America? I mean, I think my original conception was something like, school boards, what are they good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again. Hey. Huh. Nice. Well done. I'm liking it. Are they vital? I mean, the big debate, you know, we're trying to raise this big question about governance and school governance. And look, you know, we look at things like this whole nature of local control, and we ask, is this still make sense right now in 21st century America? It had a very unique history in the United States. We're the only country in the world that does anything like this in terms of 15,000 local school boards. Is it time to think about something else? And most of the time, this gets phrased as maybe mayoral control versus school boards or appointed boards versus elected boards. I'm willing to ask even more. Do we need local school districts at all? Or could we just have states run education? And that would likely mean the only way that's going to really work is if they provide a lot of school level autonomy and there's less of a middleman in between.
Well, I think there are so many different options here. Like you said, there's having a state level entity. You could consolidate districts to all be county level districts. You could just eliminate, you know, school boards and districts completely. I don't think the problems that we're looking at that, you know, we're relating back to the school board as the school board's unnecessary, doesn't need to be there. I don't think they're necessarily problems with the school boards. I think they're problems with how they're set up. And so, yeah, changing to something like appointed rather than elected officials so that members aren't beholden to unions, I think that would be an important step.
And the reason they're beholden to unions is that many members run with union endorsement and union financial support.
Yeah, and we actually had the president, I believe, of the Montgomery County School Board here yesterday. And, you know, he sat there and said, of course, I'm not beholden to the union. You know, I'm an upstanding person. They might have supported me, but I don't feel the need to institute everything that they want me to. But as Checker pointed out, there's no way to measure that across the board. There's no way to guarantee that everyone won't be like that. You know, of course, there are some quality union board or school board members out there, but without the ability to make sure that no one is beholden to something like a teacher's union, mm-hmm. that's, you know, the kind of this perverse labor slash, you know, policy interaction, it just I think they do need to, they definitely need to change at least to appointed.
Well, I think at the very least, looking at the difference between a Montgomery County, Maryland, you know, 140,000 kids, the county as a whole has more than a million residents, you know, versus Edison, New Jersey. We had Gene Maroff on the panel as well, and he's the president of the Edison, New Jersey School Board. They are considered a big school district in New Jersey because they serve 15,000 kids. Most of these school boards serve something like 1,500 kids.
And he actually pointed out there are some school boards that serve no children because they actually don't have any schools in their district. They just send school, they're just in charge of sending children to other districts.
Right, right. So, you know, I think we have to, I mean, this provides an opportunity for us to study this that says when people think about local control, if they're talking about, you know, real local, like in their town, you know, overseeing, you know, a couple elementary schools, the middle school and the high school, like that's one thing. We don't have local control then in Maryland, where it's countywide, in North Carolina, in Florida, and many other places where they have countywide systems. Those aren't all that local anymore. And does that make those schools any worse? Does it make the system work any better, any worse? Inquiring minds want to know. Okay, next topic, Daniela.
Okay. 2011 is shaping up to be a monumentous year for state-based education reform, yet some, like Richard Whitmire, fear a backlash if reformers push too hard too fast. Should we be pushing full steam ahead?
So let me see if I got this right, Mike. Basically, Whitmire is arguing that governors like Kasich should not be kind of bundling together school reforms and reforms that have to do with finance and collective bargaining, because he's just going to, you know, antagonize the enemy and make them more powerful, and everything's going to be, you know, completely eliminated in the end.
That was his argument, as I understand it.
Yes. Okay. What do you think?
Now, I should clarify. Look, I wrote a blog post about this, and I said that, you know, I think that Whitmire is right, Richard, that in the medium term, we're going to see a backlash in a place like Wisconsin or in Ohio or some of these other places where there's been a serious push to minimize collective bargaining rights, to push for tenure reform, to push for vouchers. I mean, all of this, the Republicans are kind of going for broke, and there's no doubt that there's going to be a backlash. The unions are going to be fired up in the next election, and they're going to paint these Republicans as being extreme and out of the center of the political discourse. In a similar way that we're probably seeing Republicans in Congress pushing hard on the budget in ways that there'll be a backlash and in the other direction. The question is, in the long term, are you better off sort of trying to you know, not stir this kind of backlash, try go slow, go steady, don't push too hard, you know, go incremental, or are you better for going for these big wins, even knowing that there might be a backlash and some of this is going to get beaten back in the medium term? And I don't know that there's a correct answer one way or the other. I would just say, look, when you look at national politics, Barack Obama went for as much as he could get in terms of healthcare reform, knowing that there'd be a backlash, and he suffered some consequences in November, but deciding that the incremental approach wasn't getting us there fast enough. I think you can make the same case for education.
I mean, I guess my question here is, how do you delineate between something that's non-education related, or I guess I should say is not a school reform, but is a finance reform? I mean, because it seems to me that you wouldn't be able to implement the types of school reform without kind of revamping this whole issues we have with pensions and with collective bargaining. And, you know, if we want to reform schools so that teachers are more professional and they're more respected and we have good teachers, how are we going to do that when you can't fire teachers and when, you know, low performing teachers, and when you can't actually pay teachers who are performing better, you know, better salaries to attract those teachers? Right. It seems to me that they're intimately related. So I don't know how necessarily you could go about one without the other.
Right. Okay. Topic number three.
Okay. Randy Weingarten angered free marketers with their Wall Street Journal op-ed this week, "Markets aren't the education solution." What is the role of the market in American education?
Well, you know, this is interesting because our colleague Terry Ryan in Ohio just wrote an editorial this week where he has a line that sounds a lot like that. That says, you know, we've learned from our hard-earned experience in Ohio that the free market alone will not produce the schools we need for poor kids. We've had an experience with charter schools in Ohio that were under-regulated for a long time. They have a bizarre governance arrangement where any nonprofit could be a charter school authorizer. And so then we had this kind of strange market in authorizing. Well, they ended up, many of them have ended up saying, hey, we'll be easy on you. Charter schools, come to us and pay us a fee and we won't give you any problems. Anyways, the point being here that that the market itself is an incomplete solution. That said, there's plenty of evidence that parental choice can be an important part of school improvement picture. it's American ideal anyways. We should be allowing people to have choices over their schools. And that there are ways to get the education system to be more responsive to incentives. And so if that's what you mean by free market, is making thinking about incentives and thinking that incentives matter, then there's still a lot of role for that. But it's not enough.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that Randy seemed to paint market, you know, market-based solutions as the end result. That, you know, people who are pushing market-based solutions in schools are doing so because they want the school system to parallel a market-based system. And that's, to me, it's a means to an end. It's a way to kind of bring in incentives into the school system to try to, you know, yes, to make it perform more like a market-based system, but in the end, to actually achieve better results, to be able to attract better people. It's all just a means to an end to me.
And then there are, of course, reformers out there who do want a pure market-based. You know, they say, look, we want to give people tax credits, regardless of their income, that they can spend on their schools and make choices, and that's the end of it. I mean, that there's very little government role in ensuring quality or deciding curricular decisions or anything else. And there's a legitimate argument to be made for that. You would probably have a system that, in the whole, might create a greater consumer satisfaction than you have today. The question is consumer satisfaction enough when taxpayers are paying the bill, when we're talking about a public good, not just a private good like education? Do taxpayers have some right to say, hey, we want to make sure that not only are parents happy with it, but that the kids are getting what they need to be productive citizens and productive in the economy?
Well, there's always a way to kind of intertwine the two, to have a market-based solution. You know, something like charter schools. Yes, you know, charter schools, some of them are bad, are low performing, but we just need to be able to get rid of those schools and, you know, cling to the ideas that are really strong and really effective that are coming out of charter schools.
Okay, well said, Janie. That's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. Thank you, Daniela.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, up next, Amber Winkler's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
You know, our producer, Joe, has indicated that we were really high energy talking about the royal wedding and less so talking about these important education issues. I think the obvious solution is to spend the rest of the show talking about the royal wedding.
Come on, research is exciting. Exciting
okay,
stuff.
Before we get to the research minute, let me ask you this. Have you all seen on Twitter the old Diane Ravitch making an appearance?
I have heard reference to that, yes.
It's very, and whoever's doing this, it's been very good. I mean, they're spending a lot of time going back, linking to old articles that she wrote, you know, making statements like, I don't know why people are so afraid of the school choice thing.
Yep.
And, you know, quoting Al Shanker saying, you know, we know that our system is broken and we need to fix it. But the big question is, who is behind it?
It reminds me of Edu Wonk Et. Remember what a big mystery that was for so long? And now it's the same idea. Like, who is it?
Yeah. And somebody actually said, maybe it is the same person.
Oh, is it
really? Maybe it's Edu Wonk Et. Jennifer, what's her name?
Yeah.
For Edu Wonk Et.
I don't know. My money's on Rick. He's been missing. No one knows where he is.
Rick?
Maybe he's in a closet tweeting under old Diane Rabbit.
It would be interesting since he has not yet learned how to tweet, you know,
that's true.
Stuff.
Yeah. Or maybe that's just a ploy.
Just a play. I don't know. Who is it? I thought maybe Jay Green or
something. I wonder how long they'll keep it up.
Yeah, it's pretty good, though.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but this is not the old Amber Winkler.
No,
it's the new Amber Winkler.
There you go.
By the way, I also thought instead of naming it old Diane Ravitch, maybe they should have named it young Diane Ravitch.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that
true.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
true.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
What you got for us?
So this week, we've got a new study out by IES conducted by Mathematica. That means it's good. That asks, do low-income students have equal access to the highest performing teachers?
This is not about the royal wedding.
Prior research has shown that schools with more disadvantaged students tend to have teachers with weaker credentials, but we know that those things are not linked to teacher effectiveness. There's actually very little research about teacher effectiveness and its relationships to student demographics. So here, researchers examined value-added scores for teachers in 10 large unnamed school districts, which comprise roughly 11,000 teachers and over 700 schools. They labeled the top 20% of teachers within each subject and grade span, meaning elementary and middle, as highest performing. In other words, students in these teachers' classes averaged greater gains across multiple years than similar students taking similar courses in the district from other teachers. All right, then they ranked the schools by poverty, finally the findings. They found that low-income students have unequal access, on average, to the district's highest-performing teachers at the middle school level, but not at the elementary level, which is kind of a head-scratcher for me. When they examined the districts individually, however, there were mixed patterns, which is understandable, meaning some had an underrepresentation of high-performing teachers at high-poverty schools, and others had an overrepresentation of high-performing teachers at high-poverty schools. It's important to note that these districts were purposefully chosen, so the findings are not generalizable. Still, this adds another interesting angle to the research around high-performing teachers and their placement.
Which leads me to ask, when the royal couple starts having children, what kind of teachers will they have?
It's going to be really not hard to figure out.
Okay. Now, this sounds like similar to a study that Eric Hanishek came out with not too long ago, showing that these differences between high and low poverty schools were less than you would think.
Yeah, and the Figlio study that said, you know what, the top teachers can kind of do a good job, whether they're in a high or low performing school, but it's the lowest teachers, I don't know if you remember the study, it's the lowest teachers that sort of, the low teachers and the high poverty schools are worse than the lower effective teachers in the, you know what I'm saying.
Now, anyway. With value added, is it easier in general to boost the value added score of a child who is scoring low to begin with?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it is, right? I mean, because on these state tests that they're using, I mean, some of these high performing kids are topping out.
Right. Ceiling.
So they also not taken into a value-added does not take that into account.
Oh, yeah, these guys do. I mean, this is, yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are top, this is like Glazerman at Mathematica, so.
But how do you handle that? I mean, I don't know how you deal with that fact that if you're talking about low poverty schools with a lot of kids that are scoring high and topping out on the test.
Right. Well, they're using like 3 or 4 years. It's like fixed effects, I'm assuming, where they're looking at, you know, prior performance and achievement of these kids and following it over time. So, I mean, they're taking into, obviously, consideration their past performance.
Yeah.
So, you know, what you would expect for one kid is going to be, you know, obviously different than another kid.
So is it fair to say that the teacher quality gap does not actually exist?
I think we're not there yet. I think that's a pretty strong statement. I mean, especially given Hanishek's and Figlio's work, which was very complex.
Mm-hmm.
I actually reread that study before I came on to look at it again. And they brought up a bunch of interesting questions, you know, but we definitely need to be looking at teachers, you know, the highly effective and the lower teachers and the types of schools they're placed in. But I think it was pretty interesting that, you know, the high, really effective teachers can keep that effectiveness no matter what type of school you put them in.
Yeah.
But it's the teachers at the lower range that we need to, you know, probably give a little more help to.
Did this study say anything about the district's other, you know, it said that they're unnamed, but did it say this district that had more high performing teachers in low poverty schools had some sort of, you know, placement practice of teachers? Or
yeah,
it didn't say anything.
They didn't
like
do that.
That.
They didn't go into any of that. And I thought they would at least name the districts, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. They were pretty hush-hush about that. So.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, this can cut a couple different ways. One is to say, hey, raise questions about the education trust line forever, saying there's this huge teacher quality gap, and therefore we need to figure out how to strip mine teachers out of wealthy schools and send them to poor schools. Raises some questions about that. The other thing, though, is that, you know, for teachers out there who feel like reformers are beating up and saying that, you know, the problem is we have bad teachers in these high poverty schools, I think it's fair to say back to the reformers, no, we don't. I mean, the evidence may be that actually we've got pretty decent
teachers
in those high poverty schools.
Right.
And
right.
So stop saying that it's the teacher's fault.
Yeah, and clearly when they look at these individual districts, there are some districts, presumably, that are doing some placement of these high, you know, hand-picking and saying, you're going to go here, you know, which is another, Mathematica is actually doing a study like that to sort of say, if you move teachers around, what is it, you know, what does it look like when they're in these different settings? But, I mean, the middle school thing, what do you guys think about that? Like, why would we see it more at the middle school?
I feel like that's because everyone avoids middle school. You only get stuck with middle school if you're at the bottom of the barrel.
I mean, the only thing I can think of is, I mean, middle schools tend to be more diverse than elementary schools, right? I mean, it's more often that you'll find mixed-income middle schools than, and at the elementary school, you know, neighborhood is mostly either all wealthy or all not. And anyways, I don't know what to think about that.
I know. I wish they had did some hypothesizing on that, but they didn't.
So what song could possibly go with this
study? Song, and this was with Joe's help, since we're talking here that some kids are more fortunate than others in terms of access to effective teachers. We have Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag, cool their red, white, we
Good song, huh, Janie?
Yeah, that's a classic.
All right. Well, it's now time for Chris Irvine's What's Up With That? I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what's up with that. What up with that? Yes, sir. Chris, before we discuss your What's Up With That, you notice that our producer, Joe, is now standing at his desk, at a new standing desk, and I ask you, what's up with that?
Yeah, he got a little scared by the Wall Street Journal article recently, and so I guess he made the change to the standing desk.
What did the article say?
It said you could die from sitting down, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the New York Times, to be exact. But that's
okay. Was it the Times? Yeah. I apologize.
But, right, by being lethargic, by not being in motion, so...
I would argue that you could also die from standing up.
Well, how is that, Janie?
You could fall over, pass out from standing up so long. You can't sit for 8 hours a day.
Well, you know, so we have a little pool going on here in the Fordham office to know how long is Joe going to be able to do this, to keep his standing desk. The problem is, you know, Joe is actually a very tall man, and so finding a table or a desk or a lectern or something that's going to be tall enough for him is a problem. He's a little stooped over right now. So I think there is some question that this might be bad for his posture, even if it's somehow good for his metabolism.
It's going to lead him to an early grave.
Okay, you heard it here first. We'll take a pool on that, too. That's a little more of a long-term one. Okay, Chris, what you got for us this week?
Well, ask any elementary school teacher about temper tantrums, and odds are he or she could entertain you for hours with bizarre stories of students losing their cool in the classroom. However, an incident occurring in Lakewood, Colorado late last month would drop the jaws of even the most veteran teachers. According to the official report, a third grade student threw a violent temper tantrum in his elementary school classroom, escalating to the point where the police had to be called after the student began ripping pieces of wood off of the walls. But even when confronted with the arm of the law, the student refused to drop the wood. Faced with the mortal threat of an 8-year-old with wood in his hand, the police naturally had no other choice but to pepper spray him. What's up with that?
What? Oh, that's not cool.
What possible excuse is there for using pepper spray on a child? According to the Lakewood Police spokesman, their officers had to do something to defuse the situation in a hurry before somebody got hurt. Is this kid a 5'10", 165-pound 8-year-old? He wasn't strapped with an explosive device. He had a couple of pieces of decorative wood paneling in his hands. Grab the wood or grab the kid. Boom, situation defused with no pepper spray necessary. But then again, we wouldn't want to run the risk of one of Lakewood's finest getting a splinter.
Wow.
I mean, I sympathize with teachers who have, you know, kids that are out of control, and there's a lot of hesitancy to, you know, grab the kid and try to subdue them because you could get in trouble for, you know, some sort of child harassment or God knows what. But it seems to me if the police are there, there has got to be a way to subdue a child other than pepper spray. It just seems so basic.
I was beyond words when I read this article and found that, you know, not only were the police in the room, but, you know, they came into the room, assessed the situation, and then decided to use the pepper spray.
So, Chris, as a high school teacher, did you ever pepper spray any of your students? I just want to be clear about this.
Even the 5'10", 150-pound ones?
No pepper spray was ever used during my tenure.
That's good. And did your assistant principal ever pepper spray you for disciplinary actions?
It came close, but no.
All right, good. I just want to make sure about that. That's all the time we have for this week for the Education Gadfly Show. Until next time.
I'm Janie Scull.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.